Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland. This week on the show, the White House seems to take a new approach to the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The approach involves a lot of Rudy Giuliani on cable news, apparently. We will talk all about that. Plus, we've got an exciting week next week ahead of the 2018 midterms. We will preview primary voting happening in four states around the country. A reminder to our listeners, please subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. And stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, May 3rd, so it's all up to date as of then. Hopefully, the aforementioned Rudy Giuliani is not appearing on cable news at all the rest of the day. But he probably is. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have on the phone Darren Samuelson, senior reporter for Politico, who is on deadline and has agreed to join us. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure thing. Happy to be on.
And in the studio, we've got White House reporter Nancy Cook. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Always good to see you.
Hi, Scott.
All right, time for our first data point. Let's dive right in. $130,000. That is the amount of money that Donald Trump's lawyer paid to a porn star in the waning days of the 2016 campaign to keep her from speaking publicly about an alleged affair with Trump. And we're talking about it because Rudy Giuliani, who is now working for Trump as a lawyer, made a pretty stunning revelation about the money this week.
Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did.
Yep.
There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
That's what Darren Samuelson is here to help us understand. So, Darren, get us up to speed. What did Giuliani say, and why is it significant?
Well, it was pretty stunning. The president had denied that he knew anything about that payment that was made by Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels. At a previous point in time, and Rudy just sort of casually says in the course of an interview with Sean Hannity, no, indeed, the president reimbursed Michael Cohen for that, and that he knew about the general arrangement, which really kind of contradicts everything that the president has been denying. The president denied this back at the beginning of April when he was approached by reporters on Air Force One. He was asked multiple times about it. Sarah Huckabee Sanders also threw in denials. And Rudy basically just turned the script around and said, well, we got to get this one out there. He later explained that was the reasoning and put that out there on Fox.
And so now I want to read a paragraph from a story we had about this to kind of explain the legal significance here. A payment intended to protect his campaign from political damage could be a violation of campaign finance law. As a candidate, Trump was permitted to spend an unlimited amount of his own funds on his campaign, but such sums should have been reported to the Federal Election Commission. So this would seem to put him in a place that could cause him some trouble, right, Darren?
Yeah, there is certainly some legal liability questions that have certainly come up in the course of the last 24 hours. That's what myself and Josh Gerstein, my colleague, are diving in on right now, trying to really get to the bottom of this. Obviously, it would play out over the course of many months. You saw immediately some campaign finance groups jumping on this last night, filing complaints, signaling that it was illegal. I know Josh Gerstein, my colleague, is sort of coming up with a question. You know, this we might end up in a situation, I don't want to steal his reporting thunder, but that, you know, we might be in a situation similar to John Edwards and that famous back and forth that happened many years ago that Josh covered blow by blow. So, at this point in time, it seems like we have another liability with the president. Obviously, this is something for the Southern District of New York, which is investigating Michael Cohen, and presumably has the goods on him. We are waiting to see where that goes down. One of the federal judges the other day said that an indictment was probably coming against the president's longtime lawyer. If that happens, then obviously everyone wonders, will Michael Cohen plead guilty and flip on the president? So, lots of unanswered questions, but Rudy did not maybe do his client very good service last night in that particular Fox interview.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you mentioned the speculation out there that Cohen is about to be indicted. I mean, when I saw this statement from Giuliani, my first thought was, you know, I wonder if the feds just raided Cohen's office and a hotel room. You know, they have a lot of material on him right now, and I was wondering if just, you know, this was material that was basically about to become public in an indictment or some sort of other filing, and if they were just decided that they wanted to get ahead of it.
Yeah, that is certainly a good theory. I mean, we're wondering why the raid happened when it did. Remember, the president denied what he did, and then I think a couple days later the raid ends up happening. So there, you know, there's a theory out there that maybe they saw, a possibility that evidence was about to be destroyed, and that's why they went in. Is the indictment happening anytime soon? I couldn't tell you that. I know that, you know, a different case out in California involving, I think it was a defamation lawsuit, has been put on hold, you know, pending what's happening in the Southern District in New York. You know, they're still just going through the evidence, if I'm not mistaken, as well, where a special master was just signed off in the last couple of days to go through that material and determine what's protected by attorney-client privilege and what the investigators can see. And from there it goes, you know, if there's stuff related to Russia, that could also end up in Robert Mueller's court, and you know, that could take a little bit of time.
Yeah.
It's all playing out, of course, you know, amid a more aggressive Trump legal strategy, a fight over the president's interview, and countless other tentacles to the Russia investigation.
Absolutely. Well, Nancy, tell us a little bit about this. I mean, even before this big revelation last night, the thing we were all watching at the White House this week was that, you know, a seeming shift in the legal strategy, including bringing on some new faces, seeing some old ones depart.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, Ty Cobb was seen as a very accommodating figure.
This was the kind of lead counsel.
Yeah, the lead counsel. And the president has had trouble actually retaining and in getting people to join this legal team. He's seen as someone who historically, you know, thinks lawyers should clean up all his messes, doesn't always pay them. So, you know, normally, just for some context, normally lawyers want to represent the president. It's seen as like a huge big feather in their cap. No lawyers really want to represent the president. But he was able to get Emmett Flood to come on. Ty Cobb is, I'm going to put this in quotes, retiring. And but I think that Emmett Flood has a reputation of being a much more aggressive lawyer. And I think that we're going to see a shift in the way that they're dealing with these investigations rather than be accommodating or produce documents or sort of sit down with the Mueller team. I think that it's going to get much, much more combative because I think that there's, it's sort of dawning on them that maybe there's more legal risk there. And then the other thing that's been happening in the White House is the president's top attorney, Don McGahn, and the president have had a rocky relationship since last March. Trump has screamed at McGahn countless times for not making the Russia investigation just broadly going away. He also blames Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation at the Department of Justice. And so there's also some speculation that Flood eventually could also take McGahn's role.
Charlie, or should I say Charles Mattesian Esquire, I want to turn to you.
That's right. Just, you're a lawyer.
just a little bit. Nancy mentioned Emmett Flood, the new attorney who's coming in to the White House to kind of take the reins of the response to the Russia investigation. And this is someone who's steeped in kind of, you know, defending presidents and going back into the Clinton impeachment.
Well, I should say that since I graduated law school, maybe 15, 17 years ago, a long time ago, you don't want to take counsel from me. But having said that, what I found most interesting about these recent hires is, number one, the Rudy pick. Because number one, he's not a workhorse anymore. He's not really doing anything. You know, he's not doing the in the weeds work. He's there to be a show horse. He's there to be good on TV. And here he went on TV.
He's leaking. Leaking himself.
And screwed it up. And so, you know, the question to me is he just really rusty? And was he sloppy? Or was this part of a grander scheme? I tend to think it's maybe the former and not the latter. But with Flood's hire, the first thing that occurred to me was we just saw what our next 18 months are going to be like, which is hell. It's going to be it's going to be even worse than normal because this is a guy
Charlie,
who's
this is so heartwarming for me covering the White House.
I'm sorry, but as bad as it is right now, it's getting worse because look at the guy's specialty, his expertise. executive privilege, impeachment. What is the first thing that's going to happen when the Democrats take back the House? And they will. They're going to take back the House. Impeachment begins. So Flood has been brought in for that. He's also brought in for all the myriad of executive privilege questions that are going to come up, and he's going to be, you know, putting his finger in all the holes in the dike the whole time. He's also ferocious from the accounts of everyone who's worked against him and with him. So you can just see, like, if you thought it was bad now, Nancy, your job just gets so much worse.
I also want to go back to something you said, Charlie. You know, you were talking about whether Giuliani, like, had a strategy or whether or not this was just sort of off-the-cuff chaos. You know, my experience covering the White House, and I covered the Trump transition, so I've been dealing with Trump world since August 2016, is there is very rarely a strategy. And if there is a strategy, it's the president has one in his own mind and doesn't tell other people. And so I just want to put that out there. The one other thing is that, you know, in the Rudy interview last night, there were some other interesting tidbits that came up that I just want to highlight from people. He also said that he didn't think that Mueller would come after Ivanka Trump. My colleague Annie Carney had an interesting piece about that early this week. But he also called Jared Kushner disposable, which I thought was pretty fascinating, because a lot of the Republican lawyers that I've talked to over the past year think that, you know, Kushner is perhaps at great risk in this these special counsel probes.
Darren, what's your latest view on that, and how the special counsel probe continues to affect the goings on at the White House?
Well, I think people like Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, you know, Don Jr., he's not in the White House, but obviously very close to the president, you know, that whole world of really big fish aren't going to get, you know, poked until the very end. This is a classic investigation where Mueller is taking his time. Remember, he's not on any deadlines. He never has been on any deadlines. A lot of what we have dealt with in the last, you know, week, if not weeks, has really been driven by the Trump legal world putting out these timelines and strategies, and we've heard nothing from Robert Mueller. He takes his time. It's actually been a while since he's really signaled anything of substance beyond, you know, the filings that they're doing in the Manafort trial, which is coming up in July in Alexandria, Virginia, the first of two trials.
So, and Manafort, of course, is Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairman, who has been charged in the Mueller investigation.
You know, Mueller is going to take his time. You know, he obviously has to deal with, as Charlie was saying, you know, impeachment and that looming threat. I mean, there's this sort of this Comey test that will hang over Robert Mueller in terms of, you know, announcing indictments going forward, pushing on other key pieces as we get closer to the midterms. The people I speak with in the legal community say he will keep his head down and he will just do his job. He is not going to be speaking out publicly, you know, in any way, shape, or form. He's not going to repeat, you know, the James Comey announcement press conference that he did before the 2016 election. You know, it's unclear whether Robert Mueller will put anything down on paper with respect to impeachment anytime soon. And he's not even going to probably use the I word when he does it. It's going to be a report that spells out everything he finds. I don't know when that report's going to hit the newsstands, let alone make its way to Congress. It could be before the election. It could be after the election. That is a huge, you know, billion-dollar question, is when Mueller will finish his work. But again, he's not on a deadline. So, you know, he could still be working into 2019. And that seems very possible, given how much more he's got to do.
And just to bring it back to the White House for two quick things, you know, this investigation has done two things. One, it has hurt the credibility of people in the White House. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for instance, has repeatedly said that the president knew nothing about the payments. And then the president himself this morning is tweeting about the payments, and Giuliani is talking about it on Sean Hannity's show. So, you know, her credibility has been shot a few different times. This is not the only instance, but this is another data point there. And then secondly, a ton of people in the White House have had to hire lawyers. You know, you don't make a ton of money in the federal government, and they've had to hire these really high-priced lawyers to defend them if they were in the room when statements are written. You know, Don McGahn has a lawyer, Hope Hicks, Reince, Steve Bannon. And so that also, the fact that all these people have had to hire counsel also means that people in the White House are freaked out about it. But more importantly, no one wants a job in the White House right now because they don't want any legal exposure. You know, if you're making like $100,000 a year and you have to hire a lawyer who charges $1,000 an hour, like the math on that doesn't work out.
Nancy, what about the person at the White House who's in charge of kind of corralling all the people swept up in this? And I'm talking about Chief of Staff John Kelly. What's happened? I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of we've seen several pretty incendiary stories about him over the last couple weeks, and his relationship with the president potentially fraying.
Yeah, he's had a rough few weeks, or a rough few months, actually. It was interesting.
Rough year.
It was funny. I talked to somebody close to the administration yesterday who said, you know, sometimes I feel like press reports about things that are going on in the White House are exaggerated. However, with all the stories about John Kelly being marginalized and the president not listening to him and people in the White House not listening to him, like, you can't over-exaggerate that enough. Or you can't sort of highlight that enough. And what happened with Kelly this week was NBC reported on Monday night that Kelly had, you know, called the president an idiot. It was an echo of another report that Rex Tillerson had called Trump a moron. There were eight sources in the story. And my reporting basically showed that, you know, that particular story didn't hurt Kelly's stature in the White House this week, because he's already so marginalized. Like, the president doesn't listen to him on personnel issues. He's making hires without him. He doesn't tell him about policy decisions. And Kelly has a very small circle of allies in the White House. And a lot of the White House staff is sort of tired of him, and they're just doing end runs around him.
Which is exactly what he was brought in to prevent, the end
runs.
Right.
Like, you know, last summer he was brought in. He was hailed as the four-star general. You know, the narrative was, this guy is going to bring order to the White House. And now, in a lot of ways, we're sort of, the feeling in the White House is more back to the early Reince days, where things were chaotic. You know, Trump was, like, people have described it to me as, you know, rather than having the president and then the chief of staff below him that kind of filters things, it's more like Trump is the hub now of a wheel, and there's just all these spokes off of him. But Trump's at the center of it, and there's, like, no one really running the show.
Wow. All right. Well, let's leave it there. A lot to keep an eye on as we go into next week, I'm sure. I mean, I can't even imagine what we're going to be talking about on the next episode at this point. Darren, thank you so much for joining us. I'll let you get back to your deadline now.
Thank you.
Nancy, thank you for joining, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Charlie, we're not going to be getting rid of you. We've got a segment on the midterms coming up.
I'm never leaving.
Okay, on to our next data point, which is four. There are four states holding primary elections on Tuesday. I know we had a few in March, but we're really kind of kicking off primary season this week. We're going to be in Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, and North Carolina on Tuesday night. That's 41 House seats, a bunch of Senate races, some governor's races. It's going to be a wild time. So with that, let's introduce a North Carolina native, Politico's Elena Schneider. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got Steve Shepard in the studio who wrote about Indiana this week. Steve, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
All right. Let's just start big picture. Let's go around the table. What's the number one race that you're watching on Tuesday and why? Elena, let's start with you.
Okay, so I'm not going to pick a North Carolina race, even though that breaks my heart. I want to focus on Ohio 12.
Okay, House race,
of course. It's a special election, and that's happening concurrent with the actual election. But I'm going to be in particular watching who comes out of that Republican primary. We've written a little bit about this, in that we've got sort of warring factions here, a proxy war that's playing out, where we've got one candidate who's supported by Jim Jordan, leader of the House Freedom Caucus, versus a candidate who's supported by Pat Tiberi, who's a classic Chamber of Commerce Republican, strong Boehner ally. And this is something that we saw play out all through 2016. This is the first evidence, the first House evidence of it, and we're going to probably expect more of this to come. And it'll just be fascinating to see what kind of a Republican comes out of that primary.
It's been happening behind the scenes for years, where you get these kind of more and more strident Republicans coming out of the primaries in these safe districts, and
right,
that's how the conference changes over time, irrespective of whether, you know, Democrats are winning more seats and Republicans are winning more seats. But besides the intra-party politics, there's some concerns among Republicans in this one that if they nominate the wrong candidate, they could actually lose the special election in this district that they've held for, you know, millennia, basically.
Right. So this is John Kasich's old seat. So there is, it's a suburban Columbus seat that is, you know, R plus 10. So Trump won it, but say by, I think, double digits, but only maybe 11. And I think that is seriously concerning for Republicans who just watched a Pennsylvania special election go down in which Trump had won it by 20 points. And so they're looking again now at this district and saying, okay, we need to get through through the kind of Republican who's going to appeal to those suburban voters, those women voters who they've been concerned about peeling off throughout the last year and a half. And some Republicans argue that Melanie Lanahan, who's supported by the House Freedom Caucus, is going to be too extreme. Just somebody that's going to alienate those kinds of voters and not get them interested in voting. And they want to put someone forward who is maybe a little more mainstream.
Interesting. All right. That's going to be an interesting one to watch. Charlie, what's your top race for Tuesday night?
Well, I'm tempted to say North Carolina 9, which is the Congressman Pittenger primary.
And Pittenger is Robert Pittenger, a Republican congressman from the 9th district elected in 2012.
Only because it's on its face so ludicrous. Pittenger's a fairly conservative guy, yet he's being framed as a squish, you know, a Republican squish, and he's not loyal enough to Trump. And for all those reasons, it's really interesting. But I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that the race that I'm most interested in, and hold your laughter until I explain, is the...
How am I supposed to hold my laughter when you tell me to hold?
It is the Joe Manchin primary in West Virginia. Nobody's talking about this primary that Joe Manchin is getting. Manchin's not going to lose, okay? I'm not saying it's interesting because it's a competitive primary in any means. But it is a fascinating race because you've got this Paula Jean Swearengen, who is a progressive activist running a long shot campaign. She was inspired by Bernie Sanders. You may have seen her in a YouTube video with Bernie Sanders during the campaign, this emotional video. And she's not going to win, but it's one of these races where it's really going to provide a window into the soul of the Democratic Party. And I think it's going to provide some insights into where the party base is at the moment. And I think in the past, West Virginia is often overlooked because it's so unique in so many different ways. But West Virginia has revealed some really interesting things about not necessarily where the country's going, but where, you know, a certain mindset of the country is. I mean, remember in the 2012 primaries, West Virginia was the place where we first saw the deep discontent with Barack Obama on the Democratic side, and where you began to see a little bit of the white working class backlash. Remember, I think it was a convicted felon who probably didn't even live in West Virginia won 40% in the Democratic primary against the incumbent president. So it gave us a little feel for what was to come in 2016 with Donald Trump. So I'm going to be watching to see what the percentage is that Paula Jean Swearengen gets against Joe Manchin.
That's a really interesting point. Steve, what about you? What's your top race you're going to be watching on Tuesday night?
Well, you mentioned that I wrote about Indiana, so I'm going to choose that one, the primary to face Joe Donnelly. We can argue this around the table. I think Joe Donnelly is the most vulnerable Democratic senator seeking re-election this year. He doesn't have the political brand.
Did you say most boring or most vulnerable?
It might be both.
One and the same.
I think he's the most boring incumbent.
Well, he doesn't have the political profile that Joe Manchin does. Joe Manchin's been elected statewide almost 4 times, I think. He doesn't have Claire McCaskill's political profile in Missouri. He doesn't have John Tester's political profile in Montana, who's been elected statewide twice. Joe Donnelly's only been elected once in 2012, and it was a bit of a fluke.
There was this sense that he kind of fell into it because his opponent had that huge gaffe on abortion.
Right. He only ran statewide because his seat was essentially disappearing in redistricting. It was becoming more Republican. He thought he had a better shot at statewide if Dick Lugar was upset in a primary. Dick Lugar was. And then his opponent made controversial comments about rape and abortion during a televised debate. And he sort of fell in. He's sort of an accidental senator.
So now fast forward 6 years, right? Now, Republicans in Indiana have been looking at him for since 2012 as, hey, this is our big shot. Like, if I can get through this primary, I can be a senator.
Right. You've got two congressmen who've been rivals for essentially their entire adult lives, both political and personal. Todd Rokita, Luke Messer. They went to the same college, Wabash College, and by all accounts, didn't like each other very much in college. We wrote about this last summer. Maggie Severance and the dearly departed Kevin Robillard,
who did not die, he just left Politico, to be clear,
wrote about this last summer in this long term rivalry that these guys have had, and it for months and months it looked like the race was going to come down to those two, and then you had this self funding businessman Mike Braun, who as of a couple of weeks ago had given $6 million to his campaign of his own money to try both in loans and contributions to try to essentially buy this nomination. He's been on the air since November when Rokita and Messer didn't go on television until the spring of this year. And by all accounts, there's zero public polling in this race, but by all accounts, he seems to be going into the primary as the favorite. And it's just a fascinating dynamic here for probably the most sought after, what I believe is the most sought after Republican Senate nomination on the ballot this November.
That's really interesting. I mean, how many times have we seen in the past where there's a three-candidate primary and two of them are really just going at each other and a third candidate kind of shoots through the middle and ends up winning? Usually, though, the two candidates at some point realize what's happening and they stop attacking each other and start attacking the new guy, whereas Rokita and Messer have really kind of kept focusing on each other, maybe right. partly out of this personal enmity that they've had for so long.
That's part of it. The other part of it is, though, they do believe, in talking to their campaigns, that they're competing for the same pool of voters, particularly around Indianapolis. A lot of the more establishment Republicans, they think that those voters have been moving between Rokita and Messer as the campaigns have been conducting polling over the past couple of months. And they do believe that if they could capture, if Rokita's campaign could capture a segment of Messer's voters, that they can overtake Braun on Tuesday.
That's really interesting. All right, I was going to pick the Ohio gubernatorial primary. You've got Richard Cordray, and you know what? Actually, I am going to pick that one. I also think it's worth watching the West Virginia Republicans, which we'll talk about in a second. But Charlie mentioned the Democratic primary in West Virginia with incumbent Senator Joe Manchin, how it is going to kind of illuminate some of the trends going on within the party right now. I think the Ohio gubernatorial race is also a really good example of that. This is the first bit, well, we had Illinois last time, but this is the first kind of big battleground statewide primary in the Midwest where Democrats got really surprisingly shellacked in 2016. They've been looking forward to this ever since then for 2 years for the opportunity with a lot of open governor's races to prove that they're not dead and buried in the Midwest. And they kind of plucked Richard Cordray, the former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau head, from his perch in Washington to run as this, you know, consumer protection themed populist with Senator Elizabeth Warren's support and all sorts of other, you know, establishment backing in Ohio. And yet, he has not quite been able to put away former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who's running against him as this kind of, you know, firebrand, longtime progressive who's saying, you know, he's been for Medicare for all before it was cool, that Cordray is a squish on guns and, you know, is not a true progressive in some of those instances. And Kucinich has very little kind of money or traditional resources behind his campaign, but he does have a lot of name recognition from his time as Cleveland's mayor and as a congressman from the Cleveland area and as a 2008 presidential candidate. And also, he has the backing of some progressive groups, including Our Revolution, the Bernie Sanders-aligned group. So Cordray is still favored, but I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there on Tuesday and to, you know, to see what the margins are and stuff like that. You know, this is a big, big battleground seat. John Kasich is retiring. It's going to kind of set up the general election in an interesting way.
I'm surprised that Cordray has struggled as much as he has. He's known in Washington here for his time with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but really he's a state attorney general in Ohio. So he has some statewide profile and he's really struggled to coalesce Democrats behind him, even if he does capture the nomination on Tuesday.
Elena, what are you looking for in, you mentioned Ohio 12, what else is coming up on the House map on the 8th that you're looking forward to? There's some battleground primaries, there's some open seat primaries.
So we've got, first in North Carolina, we're going to be watching whether two congressmen are potentially going to go down in primaries. The chances, based on my reporting, as of right now, that seems pretty unlikely in both cases. Charlie mentioned Pittenger, who's out in the Charlotte suburbs. He's had a really robust challenge back in 2016, and people believe that basically he was caught sleeping, that, you know, the 200 vote margin in that primary is probably not going to repeat itself in 2018. He's really woken up. He's really paying attention. He's mentioning Trump in every other breath to try and get himself across the finish line there. That being said, though, I was just on the phone with a Democrat who was saying part of what makes that primary, though, exciting is that if Pittenger comes through it and Mark Harris, who's his Republican primary opponent, loses, that's a pretty embittered and divided party that they're heading into a suburban seat in which the Democratic opponent, Dan McCready, has presented himself as a very much a suburban sort of, not Republican light necessarily, but a super moderate Democrat, and having a depressed, unmotivated Republican base in a blue moon year. So this is where no Republicans are at the top of the ticket. No one's running running for Senate or for governor. It's just going to be the House members who are going to be motivating turnout. That could be a real problem for Pittenger to have a really nasty primary that he's been presented with.
Can I just say that the member caught sleeping primaries are by far the best primaries to watch,
yeah.
too. I like them even better than the scandal primaries because it's almost what people don't realize is how hard it is for a member of the House to lose their seat. It's really hard. And typically, you know, in a situation like this, like Elena's talking about, you know, you have to either lazy as a member or have really bad constituent service back home or get overconfident and cocky.
And or have an ethics issue.
Yes, but I count that on the scandal. It's the member caught sleeping that's awesome because at a certain point, and you can always see it, whether in the FEC filings or with the events they schedule, there is that moment of reckoning where they're like, oh my God, I might lose the seat. And then the freak out begins.
Right. Well, I was just going to add, too, that you're also going to see that inevitably in the general elections where we're going to have potentially several more John Micahs, who was a congressman down in Florida who didn't realize until maybe late September of 2016 that, oh no, I'm really, really in trouble here, and started freaking out. And I think that generally Washington sort of shrugged at his struggle because people have been telling him this whole time. So I think it's not limited to the primaries. We're going to see plenty of that in the general too.
And it's interesting, Elena, that you bring up North Carolina as one of these places where we're watching for this, right? This is a congressional map that was heavily gerrymandered that's been held up by Democrats as one of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. And yet we've got at least a couple, maybe three competitive races shaping up there.
Right. And North Carolina, look, it's been it's still working its way through the courts. It's still before the Supreme Court right now as to whether or not it's gerrymandered in a way that's at all fair. Democrats say it is not. And so Republicans have built a map here where they want to be able to win with, about 60%. They've got three congressional seats that are very heavily Democratic. And then the rest are somewhere, you know, Democrats perform usually 43, 44, 45. And at a certain point, if Republicans are depressed in a blue moon year and Democrats are highly energized, the wall that they've built for themselves in a map like this is not actually all that sturdy of a wall, and it can be breached pretty easily. So we might not just see somebody like Pittenger or Ted Budd, who is a freshman congressman who just got elected. Those are the two most highly targeted seats, but then we've got people on the edge. So George Holding in Wake County, which is right outside of Raleigh, Richard Hudson in outside of Greensboro. It opens up some options here for Democrats, which Republicans wouldn't have expected in any other year.
That's really interesting. Steve, one more primary I want to make sure we cover before we go out here. We talked about Joe Manchin. The Republican race to face him has been completely nuts. I'm very curious to see how that turns out on Tuesday.
Yeah, I can't believe we haven't gotten to this yet.
I know, I know.
Congressman Evan Jenkins, State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, and convicted criminal Don Blankenship, a former coal baron who went to jail over safety. Baron is always a great title. Who went to jail over safety standards at one of the mines that his company owned. 29 people were killed. They're facing off in this primary. There was a freakout. You mentioned freakouts. There was a freakout about a month ago that Don Blankenship, who had spent a lot of his own money on television advertising, more than $2 million, that he had surged to the front of that pack.
A freakout among Republicans in Washington.
Yes. And that he had surged to the front of that pack and would be borderline unelectable when it came down to a general election against Joe Manchin, even in is a state that has moved so far to Republicans at the national level as West Virginia. The last few polls have showed Blankenship sliding back into third place, with Jenkins and Morrissey jockeying for first and jockeying for the nomination. Blankenship has doubled down on his bombastic campaign. He's got a new ad in which he makes reference to Mitch McConnell and cocaine.
Oh, come on. Finish it. What's the nickname?
Cocaine Mitch?
I've had Eric Clapton stuck in my head all week because it's not clear why he made that reference, but here we are.
Something with Mitch McConnell's wife and her family, Elaine Chao, Trump's cabinet secretary. Look, there are a lot of folks who think that a lot of Republicans who think that they've been basically able to cut off Blankenship at the knees, and that this is going to come down to Morrissey and Jenkins. But
you know, this is one of those, no one saw a convicted felon getting more than 40% of the vote in the Democratic primary in 2012, as Charlie mentioned earlier. West Virginia has been home to a lot of political surprises, and everyone, it's a state that closes pretty early on Tuesday night. All the states close pretty early on Tuesday night, which is wonderful. Please follow along at Politico.com. We're going to be watching whether to see if they really have National Republicans spending a lot of money to run negative ads against Don Blankenship, if those have worked and they'll deny him the nomination.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for the roundup, guys. Like Steve mentioned, follow along at Politico.com on Tuesday night. We are going to have live results on the page. We're going to have updating stories, and all of us are going to be involved in a live chat that's also going on during election night. So please tune into that. In addition, on Monday, we're going to have another chat, kind of a preview edition, going on Politico's website. So look out for that on Monday as
well. Send us your questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Elena, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Steve, thank you for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And Charlie, thank you for being here as always.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay, and as promised, we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Julian Pinney of London is going to help us out with a transatlantic edition of the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Bridget Mulcahy and Michaela Rodriguez, with help this week from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
That was excellent. Thank you, Julian. Listeners, we found Julian because he emailed in to say he was a fan. If you are a Nerdcast fan who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. We will talk to you again next week.